Maddie knocked down another belt of vodka after checking her rearview mirror for cops. She noticed a black Suburban behind her following a bit closely. The National Car of Texas, someone had called the Suburban. God, she hated those big-ass mom cars. She had seen so many Suburban moms at the wheel feeding their progeny juice boxes on the way to Houston's endless soccer fields. They ignored the needs of the drivers around them. She'd never be like that. 2 hours passed while she drove fast, but not dangerously so. She had outlasted most of the pokey commuter traffic out of the Houston suburbs so she could relax for a while. She speeded up through the swath of anonymous and boring countryside that stretched toward Dallas. The sky had darkened, landmarks had disappeared, and the trip should be a breeze until she reached the outer limits of the big city. She just needed to keep herself awake because the drive was boring. She drained the last dregs of vodka, stowed the remains of the flask in the glove compartment, and turned on the car radio. A station playing 80s oldies, Blair, John Mellencamp singing, "I fight authority, authority always wins. I've been doing it since I was a young kid. I come out grinning. I fight authority, authority always wins." She turned up the radio louder, and her lips curved into a smile. She loved that song's spunky celebration of the fighting spirit. It should be her mantra. She had always battered her head against closed doors. Small-town sheriffs, mayors, county commissioners, even governors, none of them liked women reporters, especially at the start of her career. Sometimes they said rude, sexist things just to throw her off her game. It didn't work. She had showed them that authority didn't always win. Sometimes the reporter won, and the public benefited. Her mind drifted to the current contest of wills between herself and the horrid Will Ward at Middle Texas College. Who would win that? She was betting on herself. She knew her core of obnoxiousness equaled or exceeded his. She was jazzed when she got the bulk of the records yesterday. Those contract documents hid a bunch of secrets, she thought, if she could just tease them out. She heard rumors about what might be going on, but didn't quite believe them. She needed Annie to sit down with her and sift through the records. Annie had the patience and the ability to see patterns when she couldn't. She wondered how her trip to interview Tom Marr was going. On impulse, she grabbed her cell phone and punched in the speed dial for Annie's cell. No answer, so she left a message. "Hey, Annie girl, hope you're enjoying yourself with Mr. Tall, Blonde, and Gorgeous. Don't do anything I wouldn't do, or should I say, don't do anything I would do. I'm on my way to Dallas. I need to pick your big brain on those college docs when I get back. Love ya, hon." She looked in the rearview mirror again. Was that the same black Suburban that was behind her earlier? Was it following her? What kind of ass would ride her tail like that? It was too dark to see. She speeded up again. So did the Suburban. Now she was getting nervous. What could she do? Not another car in sight to help her. The big car was practically attached to the rear of the BMW. Suddenly, the Suburban tapped her car bumper, a chilling way of confirming it meant trouble. Maddie went faster, sweat beating on her forehead, trying to shake her menacing black shadow. She hit a big pothole where the right lane joined the shoulder. "Oh, my God," she thought, as her car slid out of control. She screamed, but she knew that no one heard. The BMW bounced off the road, skittered in the brush beyond the shoulder, and hit a large tree. She felt a flash of fear as her head hit the windshield. She passed out.
That was Nancy Stansel reading from her debut novel, Saving Texas. Nancy worked for the Houston Chronicle as an investigative reporter and later as an editor at the Charlotte Observer. She recently returned to North Carolina from 3 years in London, where she wrote this first novel. She lives now in Charlotte with her husband. Welcome to Write on Radio, Nancy Stansel.
Well, thank you, Ian. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, congratulations on this new book. That must feel very good, having this out.
It does indeed. Very strange, but very good.
Very strange. Huh? So tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book, what it means, a little bit about the plot.
Well, I think the reason I wrote about the book was when I went to London, I finally had the time and the space to write something that wasn't a daily piece of journalism. I'd done journalism for several decades, and it tends to take a lot of your energy, your creative energy. So when I went to London, I had free time suddenly, and I thought, I'm just going to play. But after 6 months, I really needed a project, and my thoughts went back to Houston and the time I spent there as an investigative reporter. And I always thought, I need to write a book about this. So suddenly, you know, I had to call my own bluff, I guess.
And you wrote it in a lovely part of London. Tell us a little bit about where you were living there.
Oh, we were living in Chelsea. My husband worked for a bank, and so they paid the freight, which was very nice for us. But it was a lovely time there, and I feel like at least I accomplished something on the many days that it was rainy and awful, and you didn't feel like getting out in it.
She was just telling me earlier that she now dreads grey weather.
Oh, my gosh. That's
my hometown's fault, isn't it? So tell us a little bit about being a reporter, what that was like, you know, how you got into it and the rest of it, and then transition from that into kind of what happens when you go from a reporter to trying to be a fiction writer. But start with your life as a reporter.
Well, first of all, I guess I left out the plot of the book when I was talking about London. Yeah. But it's about an investigative reporter who's a little bit bored. She's looking for the big story, and it hadn't come to her yet. So she gets this chance to interview Texas' first modern-day secessionist candidate for governor, and she jumps on it. And all of a sudden, she's in this big thing of there are a couple of murders, there's a love triangle, there's corruption, there's newspaper problems, and she's just sort of immersed in this big story that turns out to be more than she bargained for. So it is, of course, fiction, but a lot of the situations in there I experienced as a reporter, and it really felt good to write about them.
The story itself is culled from the sorts of stories that you dealt with when you were a professional reporter?
Well, the secessionist part is obviously fiction, but a lot of the political situations and a lot of the situations that you run across being a reporter. When I was an investigative reporter, I was often going into situations where they hated me. And, you know, they would walk out on interviews and they would try their best to embarrass you. They would televise interviews hoping to catch you in some kind of bad situation. I would meet sources kind of on cutoffs on main roads where they didn't want to be seen, talking to a reporter. I mean, all those situations are kind of reminiscent of what I experienced, but the storyline, of course, is fiction.
So in the passage that you read, that character named Maddie, she's another reporter. She's not the main character in the story. And, of course, she gets bumped off the road here. And it sounded as though what you were talking about through her voice was something you'd really experienced then.
I was never bumped off the side of the road.
No, but the intimidation and the sexism.
Absolutely. When I became a reporter, it was in the 70s. And people didn't take women as seriously as they do now. And you would go into a small-town sheriff's department and they would talk about your legs, you know, and they didn't take requests for information seriously enough. Laws changed and society changed. And I think now women reporters have an equal playing field.
It seems it's so ridiculous. It seems ridiculous now that they would do that. It's laughable.
It is. It is laughable, but those were different times.
Mm.
But I think that it's always been difficult for reporters out there, especially investigative reporters, that are trying to find out something that somebody wants hidden, which is the definition of investigative reporting.
Sure. All right. Well, talk a little bit about your time in London and how you grappled with what must have been a challenging move from a completely different kind of writing, journalistic writing, into fiction writing.
Well, I think it may have been a little bit easier for me than someone who never wrote. Obviously, I'd written for daily newspapers all my life, and I was used to just sitting down at a typewriter and composing. You know, there were no drafts. There were no pads of paper except the ones that you took notes on. You just sat down and wrote, and you were staring down a deadline. So I think that breeds a certain kind of discipline where I was able to sit down, you know, most every day and spend a couple of hours writing. And I would read a lot of books, a lot of novels, a lot of books on writing, and just sort of try things out. But I mostly just went to tell a story of what it's like to be a reporter, what it's like to face down trouble, and how to come out on the other side.
Mm. You have a lot of colleagues, I think you were telling me earlier, that for various reasons might be interested in writing novels, ex-journalists like yourself, or perhaps practicing ones that you're currently. What advice would you give to them?
Well, I would tell them to sit down and do a certain amount every day until it feels more natural. I would say to try to immerse yourself in the character, to not put the repertorial kind of voice on it. That was something that was hard to learn, how to be in a character's head instead of telling it, showing it. I used to write very terse sentences, but I tried to learn to write more flowing, kind of artistic sentences. Obviously, I'm not quite where I'd like to be as a writer, but I feel fortunate that I've sold my first book and that I can keep on learning.
Mm, mm. What if you had to go back to journalism? Would the fiction writing screw up your lovely style as a journalist?
Well, I think that the journalism I did was kind of almost a different era, because in the past 10 years, people have laid off, newspapers have laid off so many journalists. And the field that I particularly love, investigative reporting, has really been decimated. There are reporters that try to do investigative reporting amid a lot of other responsibilities. But newspapers used to have large teams of investigative reporters, and that's not happening as much these days. Usually newspapers try to keep an investigative reporter or two, but they just can't staff things the way they used to.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think they have the budgets anymore to involve a reporter for 3 or 4 days or even weeks on a story, because they need to get something out tomorrow. And so that's, like you say, that kind of puts the end to the whole notion of true investigative reporting, because you've got to get your story out by 6 p.m. or 10 p.m. or whatever the deadline happens to be.
Absolutely. And, you know, I spent months on stories. Well, they were usually series, projects. And it was wonderful having the luxury to do that, but I really felt like I was doing the Lord's work. I felt like, you know, investigative reporting really adds to our democracy. You know, it really does right wrongs. It changes people's lives. It changes policies. It changes government. I've seen it happen over and over again, and that's why I feel so strongly about it. I'm donating a portion of my royalties to my favorite organization, the Investigative Reporters and Editors. It's a national nonprofit organization that teaches reporters investigative techniques. And a few years ago, I set up a fellowship in memory of my dad, who is also a journalist. And what I'd like to do is make some money off this book and donate it to a good cause.
That's a great idea. Amy wants to say something.
Does fiction have that same kind of power for you?
I think fiction has a power of its own. You know, it may not right any wrongs, but you can certainly open people's eyes, change their opinion, or at the least produce a work of art that will take away their daily worries for a few hours. Yeah. Books have always done that for me, you know, just to disappear into a world where you can totally relax and enjoy that other life. You know, that's just a wonderful thing if you can achieve that.
Well, you said to me earlier, before we were on air, that sometimes this felt a little bit like a homage to journalism.
Yes.
An art which seems to be disappearing a little bit. And sometimes you seem to get a little emotional around that. Did you try to bring that emotion into the book? I mean, this is an incredible page turner, this book.
And
the thing is that what seems to be at the core of it, sort of socially, is the breakdown of journalism.
Right. There's a parallel story going on in this book besides the secessionist plot. Her newsroom is also being decimated in some ways. You know, a new publisher comes in, the paper is sold, the publisher cuts, you know, I don't know, 15% of the newsroom. People wait around and see if they're going to get the call that their jobs have disappeared. You know, Annie's favorite editor gets cut. I mean, it's really real-life stuff that happens all the time these days, unfortunately.
I don't know anything about that.
Oh, poor Steve. Poor Steve. Well, talking of real-life stuff, let's go to the center of this, and that's the Texas secession. I know you know lots about that, and I'm sure probably Steve does too. I'm very interested to find out more about it and to have you tell our listeners really what's going on with that in real life and how you handle it in the fictional world.
Right. When I started, well, I got the idea for this angle after hearing what Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, said in 2009. He said, basically, if we don't like what's going on, you know, well, you know, we'd hate to do it, but we could leave this country. He didn't say it in quite that open a way, but it was very obvious what he was saying. And this is just a theme throughout Texas history. For one thing, when Texans fought the war for Texas independence from the Mexicans, they became a nation for 10 years before they were admitted to the Union. And I think that spirit is still out there. Texas really does think it's a country all of its own, I think. I mean, I lived there for 15 years, loved it dearly. But over and over, I would hear people say, I couldn't move from Texas. It would be almost unpatriotic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are all kinds of I think there was a slogan at one time, Texas, it's like a whole other country. But I was noticing even a month ago, a Republican candidate for attorney general said Texas could be an independent nation if this country collapses, because he said that it was in such great shape with its energy and economic practices. He said it could be a standalone entity with energy, food, water, and roads. And then he said, of course, I don't want to secede, but you hear this over and over again, so it really just kind of fired up my imagination, I guess.
And there's a lot of people in Texas that believe that they have the right to secede, even though they don't have any more right to secede than any other state, but they feel that they have this special right to do so because of the fact that they were admitted as a separate nation into the United States, and they feel like the way that the agreements were drafted, they have this something extra special that no other state has. Of course, that's not true, but a
no,
lot of them believe that.
It isn't true, but there is a section in the Texas Constitution that says they can change their government if they don't like it, and I think that always draws some comment from secessionist proponents. But it's amazing how many groups are out there on the web that want to secede, and occasionally they'll put up a billboard somewhere, and occasionally they'll march in a parade, and they sell a lot of Texas memorabilia to try to raise money. But you wonder kind of if sometime at some point these groups will coalesce and something would happen. Yeah. I mean, it's not out of the realm of the imagination for sure.
And that's what you've written about, is the imaginatory sense that this has become serious.
Exactly.
Tell us just the core of that. Don't give too much away, but just the core of how that happens in the story, because it's very compelling.
Well, I guess without giving too much away, there's this candidate for governor who's basically a good man, but he has several people behind him pulling strings, and they also have a beautiful, deadly assassin who is the girlfriend of one of the conspirators behind the candidacy, and so she is dispatched when there's an inconvenient problem, and she can take care of it in a very professional way.
And that's partly what you were reading from, which
exactly
which happens very early in the book, so we're not giving very much away.
Yes, you know. There's much, much action after that.
Guess who's driving the black Suburban? And it's and you do know who it is, so we're not giving anything away there. By the way, I love the character. The character's called Alicia, and she's a woman assassin, and she's really well drawn, and I think after the fact she seems to have some parallels in real life. Yeah
possibly so.
Yeah. What's that South American woman's name that was just murdered? I don't remember it either.
Don't know at the moment. I sort of based her on out of Peru, and The Shining Path. She was, I sort of invented this backstory for her that involved The Shining Path and being kidnapped and brutalized. So I think that's just an example of the fun that you can have with fiction. Mm. You can take some character and invent this very colorful back history, you know, as long as it comports with what might actually happen in real life.
Mm. Well, we've got a couple of minutes left. Tell us a little bit about what else you're doing and about the plan that you have for this book and other books.
Well, this book just came out last week, published by a Texas publisher, and I'm going down to Texas for 2 weeks to the Texas Book Festival and some events there. Then I'm going back to Charlotte and trying to publicize it through the writer community there. I'm finding that my journalism training is coming in handy with the publicity effort, because it feels like kind of second nature to be out there. When I was a investigative reporter and our projects came out, they would usually create some kind of stir, and you would be on TV or you would be on the radio and talk about them and what they meant and what you hoped would happen with that. So I feel like I'm a little bit on familiar ground, except this time, instead of trying to draw attention to my story, it's more like kind of selling yourself as an author, I guess, which is a bit different and a bit embarrassing, but So be it.
Yeah, you're doing very well. And you've got, my understanding is this is the first book in a trilogy?
Yes, I'm actually writing the second book now, and it continues the secessionist theme and some of the characters, at least the ones that weren't killed off in the first one. And I think it will be a pretty interesting book.
Okay, well, fantastic. And we wish you massive success with this book.
Well, thank you so much.
Hope you will come back with the next one. You're listening to me, Ian Graham-Leask, and my colleagues talking to Nancy Stansel about her new book, just out, Saving Texas. Good, easy title to remember. Thanks for being on the show.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.